Good evening. I'm Mary Andrees, your host for this three-part series called Louisville Punks, a radio history that examines the city's first punk scene during the years 1978 to 1983. In 1978, I was a 13-year-old living in Jacksonville, Florida, so like many of you, I missed the scene firsthand. Fortunately, I've had the pleasure of talking with many of the musicians involved, from bands like The Blinders, Your Food, Skull of Glee, and more. I also interviewed Jeff Jobson, filmmaker who captured many of these bands on glorious black-and-white VHS tape. He also wrote the liner notes to the recently released CD, Bold Beginnings, an incomplete collection of Louisville punk, 1978 to 1983. This CD was released at the same time I was collecting vinyl 45s and EPs released by the bands in question, and many of the songs you will hear in this series can be found on Bold Beginnings. During its heyday, punk shows were attended by relatively few, but those that did go spanned all economic classes. It was also the first time many of those making the music were women. And the original punks left one more legacy to Louisville, that of a city which even today sustains a vibrant and truly original music scene. So come back with me now to a different time. It's the summer of 1978. Pope Paul VI is laid to rest. Grease is the number one movie at the box office, and the song Last Dance, performed by Donna Summer, is the year's number one hit single.
So let's dance, let's dance, let's dance, let's dance.
Here in Louisville, Mayor William Stansberry runs into political trouble when he claims to have been on a business trip in Atlanta when Jefferson County firefighters go out on strike in July. The Courier-Journal reveals he was actually in New Orleans with his beautiful blonde administrative assistant. Also that summer, a young man named Sandy Campbell is looking for a job.
I met Tony Pinotti the summer of 78 at Rock Creek. Actually, I was at the park across the street, and he was taking a break, and I knew him a little bit, and he said, I told him I needed a job, so he got me a job at Rock Creek cleaning horse stables for the summer. And he asked me to come out to see his band that he had just formed out later, a little later. Asked me to see the band he had formed out at the Louisville School of Art, so I went out there with him and was just floored. It was wonderful. It was no fun. Extremely fun, actually.
Shortly thereafter, Sandy runs into guitarist Rick LaTondra.
He says, we got to form a band now. And I said, sure, let's do it. So I went and bought a $90 bass and a Hondo bass, as in fret Hondo. And we formed a band to back up No Fun. We played at the Cloister. We played at an opening, an art opening downtown at 2nd Street.
That's the one I saw.
Yeah.
Old Galt House.
The Old Galt House. And we played out at an East End party one time and had full bottles of beer thrown at us.
Wow.
Which was great. It was great for our image.
Early audience member Steve Rigaud, later known as Chili Rigaud, recalls his first impression of the I-Holes.
I had not released anything like this in Louisville at all. It was kind of a combination of, it's where punk and art met, you know, every once in a while, and they really did meet head on with the I-Holes. They were incredible.
Unfortunately, there are no known recordings of the I-Holes, except...
There's one recording of us live, and it sounds just like chainsaws. But people were dancing.
Without anything being said, I can smell it in the next room. It's in the sheet. And now, Sister Serene, Sister Success, Sister Heroine holds out her hand to him from Une Autre Cité.
That was The I-Holes, recorded on VHS tape by Jeff Jobson in 1978. Like the first Louisville punk band, No Fun, the I-Holes were short-lived.
Our drummer mutinied us and went to No Fun because they were the better of the two bands. Mm. And after that, we never played out again. Couldn't get a drummer.
Steve Rigaud and Sandy Campbell got to know one another better when Sandy got a job at Karma Record Store on Bardstown Road.
How I got in it was kind of through Sandy, because I got a Karma Records. And I remember seeing a few posters around about a festival that was going on in Indiana, and being a Hoosier, there was like me and a few other friends that I have that were into like the latest record, the latest thing, and we were kind of into punk and, you know, no wave and the New York punk scene. And so I would go in the record store and Sandy say, oh, have you heard, you know, blah, blah, this or that and blah, blah. And Sandy would turn us on to whatever was happening in the city. And I mean, I went to the first festival that was in the Elkhoff Barn. And I met some people there, but Sandy was throwing a New Year's Eve party at 1069. Right. And Sandy lived there at the time, and he said, come to the party. So I did.
1069 refers to a rundown house at 1069 Bardstown Road. Now a Taco Bell parking lot, it was then a rehearsal and living space for many of the early punk bands. Guitarist Wink O'Bannon recalls.
It was hot and filthy, and everyone was suicidal.
The suicidal is a new aspect. I've heard the hot and filthy, but the suicidal I hadn't heard yet.
Well, I'm not going to pursue that, but yeah, it was people were depressed and estranged. And you're talking about a place where at one point Catherine Irwin and her friend Michelle were living in the basement. In the basement there was basically a root cellar.
Ooh.
It was a trap door straight down, as I recall. Yeah, if you didn't have any place to go, you ended up there.
Sandy remembers it well because he lived there.
And I moved in. I knew Terry Barr, and she had a friend there. I don't know what her name was, but there were three of us living there. And then near the end, there was 12 of us living there, all of us in bands, barely making the $150 rent. It was a great place to. Now looking back
a great
on
time.
It, looking
really
back
good time.
On it, it was a great time in my life. But living it was a little different.
Through contacts made at punk shows and at 1069, Steve decided the time was right to form his own band.
I had met somebody there named Joe Fry and Alice Howard, and Alice and I became pretty good friends. And Joe, we were all kind of friends. And I think we were just kind of like goofing around and said, you know, we should start a group or whatever. And he said, well, that, you know, yeah, we'll do it or whatever. So I started, before we even had a group together, I was making posters promoting the group before the group ever happened. And so I would go around, you know, and put up these posters. And I thought, well, you've just lost your mind because you don't have an actual group together, but you're putting up posters. And from those posters, too, we got more people into the group. Through seeing posters through Joe Fry. So Joe Fry kind of pretty much lined up the group, and I came in with him and kind of organized the whole thing. So it was like him kind of, we had people like coming through the poster and then coming through him, and I think it ended up the people that knew him were the ones that stayed.
Thus was born the End Tables.
Our next song is about marriage. I hope nobody out there is married. I'm not putting you down, I'm just saying it doesn't work.
song They're Guilty by the End Tables. I asked Steve why he chose that name.
That happened one night with a good friend of mine, Sherry Dietrich. We were sitting around. It was Sherry and another friend of mine, Robert Wardell. He's also a good friend of Jill's. We were all sitting around and we were kind of making jokes about what a great punk name would be. And we were going through like dishwashers, refrigerators, and, you know, we were going through like the whole list. And then all of a sudden, you know, she goes, the end tables. I said, wait a minute, that sounds pretty good. So, but it's all kind of sitting around. That's how the end tables happened.
In his July 2007 article in Louisville Magazine called When Punk Rocked Louisville, Babylon Dance Band singer Chip Knoll described Steve as having the build of a football lineman and the manner of a 1940s starlet. Chip continues.
Why on earth would anybody choose to be a punk rocker in Louisville, Kentucky? I mean, why would you choose a position that isolated? Well, if you did, you had to be, just by definition, you had to be an interesting person. And so you have all these people like Steve Rigaud is just a fascinating guy and really smart. I mean, almost everybody on that scene, I mean, you know, there were very few people you thought, boy, how does that person get dressed in the morning? I mean, everybody was very smart and interesting. And so, as I said, I mean, everybody got into it. If you got into it, the only reason you did was to express something about yourself. And then, you know, and we always talk just about the bands because it's easiest to remember that. But the other thing was, not only you didn't just have to be an interesting person to be in a punk band, you had to be an interesting person to show up.
I think the first show we ever played was a Babylon dance band party. And they asked us, they knew that we had a group together, and they asked us to play their party. So I think that was the actual first show we ever played. And people were kind of freaked out when I came to the show. Not that it was really that freaky, but people were kind of, I don't know why they were freaked out, but they were a little freaked out. I think a lot of it had to do, well, a lot of it sometimes with the act, but mainly in this case, I think there was so many people. Mm-hmm. In the first incarnation of the End Tables, they didn't know what to think. There was like 10 people in that group.
Filmmaker Jeff Jobson describes his first impression of the End Tables.
I'd seen a practice in a garage somewhere where there, I mean, you had horn players and you had a drummer and a percussionist, and Rigaud was out in front of everything.
The End Tables' next gig occurred at the Red Barn on the University of Louisville's campus in 1979.
Rigaud was just mind-boggling as far as a showman goes. I've never seen a better frontman ever in any band anywhere. He was mesmerizing. You just looked at him and you couldn't keep your eyes off
him.
That was the song The Defectors by the End Tables, recorded in 1979 at Reel to Reel Studios. Eventually, the band narrowed its membership down to Rigaud, Stephen Humphrey on drums, Alex Durig on guitar, and his brother Albert on bass.
We rehearsed a lot. We would get rehearsal spaces and just rehearse a lot. And in the beginning, I wrote most of the songs, and then Alex and Albert would come in and like do songs, and then they would say, well, what do you think? And I'd say, well, it sounds good to me. So then it became like Albert and Alex, and then Albert kind of dropped out, and then it became all Alex. So it was one of those things where I was the originator of all the music. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of dropped, you know, since I wasn't a guitarist, I kind of got dropped down in ranking, and then...
No, you were the vocalist.
I know.
All those words were yours.
I know, but okay. I wasn't a composer, so they couldn't very well say, you know, I play the guitar, you don't play the guitar. Why are you trying to tell me how to play the guitar? And then and the thing is, it was kind of funny, and I understood, and I wasn't really that offended by it, but when I had well, come in with like a good riff or a tune on a bass, because that's how I compose, mm-hmm. you know, they would listen to it, and sometimes I'd use like pieces of it, mm-hmm. and I got to the point where pieces weren't used anymore. Isn't that sad? Isn't that sad out there?
It's so pitiful. Brings a tear to my eye.
And Albert would, a few times I composed with Albert on his bass, mm-hmm. and we got together and composed, which is kind of funny. And that's how I kind of got down to Alex doing all the composition and me all lyrics.
How did the lyrics come about for you? Was there a particular...
Somebody told me a story, so I just transferred it.
Is that how a lot of those...
A lot of them. Yeah, a lot of people think they're autobiographical or not. It's like rearranging a story.
And what's your favorite recording that you got to make?
Probably White Glove Test.
That was White Glove Test by The End Tables. Meanwhile, former I-Hole bassist Sandy Campbell continued to expand his musical horizons while working at Karma Records.
It was a great time in music. I hadn't heard of punk at all. I mean, I liked the New York Dolls when they were out. I liked just rock and roll. Oh, I was really into 50s rock and roll, and New York Dolls were playing that, but louder.
Mm-hmm.
And then these covers started coming out that were just wild covers. The Damned had covers. Their first album cover had them with shaving cream all over them. And then Richard Hell had one with his shirt ripped open, says, "You make me," and then just a blank. And I said, "Man, what is this about?" And I was just buying them by the cover. You know, just whatever. If the cover looked good, I bought it. I mean, the Pistols had the lime green with the orange background and just, you know, wow, look at this stuff. This is way un-Led Zeppelin. So I was buying all this music and just going, just freaking. And then it was, oh, God, if they have 20 songs per, you know, per LP, this is amazing, because most albums then had two or three songs per side.
Mm-hmm.
So if it had a 10-song side, it was like, oh, this band's good. They're back to the two-minute, yeah, you know, three-chord songs. So, and Karma Records was one of the only record stores in town selling a lot of this new wave punk music. Jim Adams was really into the art scene, and he knew his stuff, and he formed a band called Blinders with no people in it.
And he, it seems to be the way it worked.
He would put up these posters.
What?
In Karma.
He was copying me then.
In Karma Records.
What a ripoff.
With just people, like the employees, with their eyes blotted out.
I remember those posters.
Yeah, so you couldn't see
their eyes. He was ripping
me
off.
Jeff Jobson continues.
Jim Adams, he was the manager of Karma Records on Bardstown Road, and he had also recently graduated from the Center for Photographic Studies, and he knew a lot of the musicians around, and because they would come in and out at Karma Records, and some of them actually worked at Karma Records. And he had this idea. He was a conceptualist artist, so he had different ideas of things that would happen. And one of his ideas was a band called Blinders, not The Blinders, but Blinders. And the idea was you'd have these musicians that would, at the drop of a hat, play anything. You know, whatever was suggested of them, they'd play. And so he got together some of the people that were involved, you know, some of the people that had hung out at Karma, and started practicing with them. And then he pulled back from it, and it kind of went off on its own, because it was kind of obvious early on that, you know, that idea wasn't going to work, but these people that were kind of playing together realized that they enjoyed each other's company, and they would continue playing. Jerry McGeorge was the husband of one of the people that worked at Karma. He was the blues harp player. He had gotten together with Buddy Mattingly, who was the original drummer, and somewhere along the line they knew Michael O'Bannon, and he was somehow or another able to drag his brother, Matthew, Wink O'Bannon. Oops. Dragged him out. He had been kind of a recluse for a while, but played very well, and he was able to be convinced to come out and practice with these folks.
Guitarist Wink O'Bannon explains the origins of the band's aliases.
Mr. Adams, the first time the Blinders appeared, the first show we did was the Red Barn New Wave Festival, regardless of the fact that the term New Wave kind of made us sick. Mr. Adams arranged for notice to be in the paper. There was some little, I don't know what it was called back then, some little section that did such things. And we really didn't want our parents to know we were in this crummy little garage band. So we had to come up with aliases. I'm talking about my brother and myself. Sandy already had 12 aliases, I think. Fred Hondo came later. I mean, that was later in the year when we came up with that one. But he was also Sample Candle and Sandy, I don't know, six different plays on his real name. But my brother and I came up with, we had to come up with fake names. And I was having trouble with mine. And I was dubbed Wink Cadaver in the parking lot of Wendy's on Bardstown Road. And unfortunately, my brother's aliases didn't stick and mine did.
What were you listening to when you started getting involved with all of this at that time?
Before punk rock, I'd pretty much given up on pop music because I don't really like the Eagles. And
I couldn't agree more.
I'm sure they have a couple of good songs. I just don't know what they are. But I had gone backwards to sort of what would now be called roots rock. And then punk came along, and that was actually through Sandy and my brother. Mm-hmm. My brother was a big one for the import picture sleeve. So I was exposed to the Pistols and the Ramones through my brother, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to shake the... I never actually shook the roots rock thing off. Hence Bodeco years later.
We all liked the Rolling Stones. Jerry was an avid blues fan, all the black blues. It's sad to say, but to get Jerry out of the band, we kept playing faster and faster.
Mean.
We were ruthless.
So you finally got harmonica less there.
Yes. Yeah, he is on the first EP that we put out.
And that was?
Last Chance EP.
That was Last Chance by Blinders. You're listening to Louisville Punks, a radio history on 91.9 FBK Radio Louisville. We'll be back with more from Blinders, also Monsters and Skull of Glee, in a moment.